Okay, so we've established so far the value of being mekabel geirim and the great chesed that is involved in welcoming a sincere ger into the community, both in terms of the overall process of preparation and the actual mahalach and the actual talich that we have to go through. All of those having mitzvah components, and perhaps a mitzvah on the ger himself, going back even to his pre-Jewish state, and how we are connected to values of Avos HaGer and Avos Hashem that express themselves through this process. So that being said, we also have to consider the other force here, and that is that there is an investigation that is supposed to take place. There is a process that we have to go through in order to evaluate what exactly are the circumstances. And this all surrounds the fact that it makes a big difference as to whether the gerus is a good idea or a bad idea. And as we saw yesterday, and we saw the day before also, all of the conflicting sources that seem to give us a mixed message, a good thing or a bad thing. So there are various resolutions. But what seemed to emerge as the most important factor is the sincerity and commitment and self-motivation. So we'll call that one factor. But those ideas are the most important, that when you're dealing with a ger who is coming on his own initiative with the proper motivation to be a part of Klal Yisrael and to embrace everything that means, then that is wonderful and we open the door wide. And when dealing with somebody whose motivations are more compromised, and as we'll see today, that can come from a few different directions. So then whether or not the gerus works is one question, but whether it's a good idea, whether it's something that we're excited about, that's where we're much more ambivalent. And that seems to be the crucial issue. So with that, let's try to figure out the process. So it is often said, this is a commonly shared idea, that a ger is discouraged, a potential ger, we give him a little bit of resistance, we play hard to get essentially, and we try to push him off three times. So the question is, where does that come from halachically? So that is common knowledge, so to speak, it's often quoted, but is that actually something that is rooted in Shas and Poskim? So where do we find this idea of three times specifically? So did you see that in the Makaris that you looked at? Did you see it in Shas anywhere? What did you see?
I heard Miguel's Rus in the Medrash.
Okay. So the Medrash in Rus is what's most explicit about this. And there's a lot to talk about. We'll see how much we can fit in. But figuring out the story of Rus is tricky. It's a very crucial story for our history. We have it read on Shavuos because it is a fundamental text relating to Gerus, and because Shavuos is the time when all of us commemorate entering into the covenant. So the Parsha of Gerus is very significant. So figuring out exactly what happened in the book of Rus, not so simple. There's a lot to try to understand. But what seems to be happening in the beginning of the Megillah is that here you have Rus is apparently a non-Jewish woman, or apparently at least somebody who needs conversion. And it's a little tricky because she had been married to somebody who's identified as one of the Gedolei Hador, Machlon and Kilion, were apparently great tzaddikim. And yet they were married to women who were Moavios, who were apparently not Jewish. And we have to figure out exactly what that means. And maybe that's a subject that we'll come back to because it impacts other areas of Hilchos Gerus. But however we got to this situation, so apparently here their husbands have passed away. And it's a question of what's going to be the next step. And their Jewish mother-in-law, Naomi, she tells them three times, Shovna, go back home. You don't have to stick with me. You don't have to be with me anymore. My sons are not alive anymore. I don't have any more, she says. So go home. So the Medrash comments there, you find Shovna three times. So that represents three efforts to try to show some resistance. But that's a Medrash Rus, not necessarily the most obvious halachic source. And the Torah Tamima, if you look, the Torah Tamima comments on this, that, you know, Torah Tamima is on the Megillah, is also in the back of the respective Chumashim. So the Torah Tamima commenting on this Pasuk in Rus, he says, Apella, because this is a important din, which we all know, common knowledge associated with Hilchus Geirus. So how come it's not in Shas? How come we don't find that in the Talmud Bavli? In the sugyas that deal with Geirus and talk about the process, how come this idea of three times is not found? So is that the case? Is it in Shas anywhere? Yeah, Ephraim?
Maybe you could say that in the Mishnah where it talks about the stuff you have to say to get to push him away. So it says first that you tell him this is Kasa Chamuros, then you tell him the about Leket Shecha Peya, and then you tell him about Gzela, Shaloni Tam Lishavon. So maybe that's the three times.
That's interesting. Okay, it's an interesting way to look at it. If you consider those three separate times, those details, it's interesting. There is a similar but different approach. Rabbi Yonah Rishlita, I mentioned him yesterday, I think, in a sefer, Kanfe Yona has an essay about this. I should emphasize that, especially as a potential musmachim, you should be aware, you probably are aware, that Rabbi Reis is a very crucial resource to Rabbanim in the field and to the Talmidim of our yeshiva, and somebody who has been very much involved in practical Dayanus issues. So you should consider him an address when you get involved in any issue like this. Maybe we'll find a time to bring him in for a guest shiur towards the end of our limudim together. But he's somebody who's a very tremendous asset to our community and to our yeshiva and to our mizmachim. And in his sefer, Kanfe Yonah, so he has a piece about Kabbalah's Gerim. And there he talks about, similar a little bit to what you're saying, but focusing on different points, that the Gemara doesn't explicitly say three, but it could be that if you look at what the Gemara describes, you get at least two and maybe three. So where do you get two? Because the Gemara does say that when somebody comes to potentially convert, so you say to him, you realize that the Jews haven't had it so easy. Right? You realize that we've had a rough time and that the nations of the world have persecuted us, and it's a rough ride. It's not exactly a smooth sailing. And are you sure this is something that you want to do? And if they say, yeah, still, this would be an honor for me to be involved with such a nation despite all that. So then, okay, then you go further. Then you go further. But then the Gemara says that you also mentioned to him that you realize that you're taking on a risk, because until now, you could be Mechalel Shabbos and nothing would happen to you. You could eat treif and nothing would happen to you. Now you're going to enter into a chi of mitzvos, so now you're taking on a lot of potential liability. And it's just worth noting, the Gemara is not spelling this out here, but this is a point that we made before. See that this is one of the reasons why we don't proselytize, because we don't feel that people are lost unless they're Jewish. Other religions believe that in order to be saved, you have to convert to their religion. And we don't believe that. So if you have a more challenging path if you're going to be Jewish, because if you're not Jewish, you don't have to keep Shabbos, you don't have to eat kosher. You just have to uphold these seven values, and that's enough. Not just according to you, according to us. That's what we believe is the obligation. But if you're going to be Jewish, it's going to be harder. So are you ready to take on this more intense burden? So already it sounds like there are two phases that the Gemara is talking about. And that initial phase, when you said to him, you realize that it's not always a walk in the park, and we're not promising you a rose garden. So that's not the final conclusion, because apparently there's still more to say. So apparently that's phase one. And then there is at least a phase two. Is there a phase three that we can see from the Gemara? So maybe, points out, because the Gemara does also say that at the very last minute, the tevila, the immersion in the mikveh, which is the end of the process of geiris. So there you have to inform him of some of the big mitzvahs and some of the small mitzvahs, whatever that means, we will get to. So it sounds like maybe that's one last shot of saying, okay, you really realize what there is here, what the details are, and maybe that could count as a third time. So what emerges is that there are different phases here, and it's not simply a question of one, two, or three, but that maybe each one has a different purpose to it. So we're not just collecting attempts, but there are different focuses in these different attempts. Baris also quotes from Rabbi Gedalia Felder in a Sefer Nachlas Tzvi that there are at least two goals in the process of pushing off a little bit, giving a little pushback. One is to make sure that the individual has the proper motivations. And the second is to make sure he knows what he's getting into. And that's important because, yes, we need to clarify that they have the right motives, but we also need to clarify that they're not going to regret it. As soon as they walk into shul and they find what they got to do, they find what all of these obligations are. We don't want there to be a harata. So we want to make sure that you have a clear picture of what you are getting into. So perhaps that's what emerges from our Gemara, that there are at least two or three phases, and Megillas Rus saying a little more clearly, as the Medrash emphasizes that from there we see an idea of three attempts. So you put the two together, that from Rus you have a number, from the Gemara you don't have a number, but you have various examples and various goals. Put them together, so you get three attempts with different points of focus, perhaps. And it's a careful balance because we have two competing goals here. So on the one hand, we want to make sure to be welcoming and to fulfill all of these mitzvah components that we spoke about yesterday. And this is not something to be hesitant about on that sense, that if there is a proper candidate here, so then we can't cost them the opportunity and we can't delay either. The Gemara says even delaying is a problem. It's a problem for the Ger, it's a problem for the Beis Din. So we have a very tricky balance. We don't really have much of a safe side here because we want to make sure that we accept the right people, but we want to make sure that if they're the right people, they're accepted quickly and without any delay. And a little bit of a sense of just how complex it is the Gemara Maseches Shabbos and Lamed Beis and Lamed Aleph. You saw that Gemara, where part of that Gemara is very well known. That it's one of the Gemaras that illustrates the different personalities of Shammai and Hillel. And the sometimes, I guess, a little cartoonish picture we have of Shammai and Hillel as they're contrasted with each other. So the Gemara talks about different people who approach them and they got different reactions because of their different personalities. So in general, Beis Shammai comes across as a little more of a hardliner, and I want to say I always feel bad. Again, I don't want to caricature, but he comes across a little bit more impatient. I feel we should emphasize that it's Shammai who is quoted in Pirkei Avos as saying we should always smile. So everybody's complex. Even the Kabbalists call them the savior upon him Yafos. But here in these stories, comes across a little bit more rigid, while Hillel comes across more welcoming. And Hillel essentially converts these people who don't always present such an easy picture. And among them is somebody who says, convert me so I can become Kohen Gadol. Now, aside from the fact that that's going to be quite a hurdle to try to clear, you don't only want to be Jewish, but you want to somehow turn into a Kohen and get selected as Kohen Gadol, so that's not so likely to happen, to put it mildly. But separate from that, it's an improper motivation. So even if this was an attainable goal, right, even if there was a path that he could become a Kohen Gadol, So still, if that's why he's doing it, so clearly that's not on the list of good motivations. And the Rambam specifically writes that somebody who's looking for a sarara, somebody who's looking for a prominent post, and that's why he's doing it, that's one of the ulterior motives that we're not happy with. So it's interesting to note that the Gemara says nonetheless that Hillel was mekabel him. So that seems to be a question. And how exactly do we relate to that fact? So Tosfos in Yevamos, you saw the Tosfos talks about this. And Tosfos on Chav Dalet in Yevamos brings up this seemingly glaring issue. And Tosfos says that Hillel was able to ascertain that whatever this guy is talking about Kuna Gedola, but ultimately he'd get to the right place. And that ultimately he would come to embrace everything for the right reasons. And it's a fascinating mix here because it calls our attention to the fact that we really have a very tricky job because we have to make sure to accept the right candidate, but also the reception makes a difference. So to be able to see the potential and to be able to know where, even if he's not presenting on its face such a good picture, that there is more to work with, takes a certain kind of insight. And the Gemara there seems to be painting a picture of Hillel overall as having that kind of patience and an insight into people that is able to see what could be, even if it's not obvious. But apparently that's also a part of the whole reception here. So it's very subtle and very tricky. And you need people to be really very discerning and sensitive and have exactly the right mix of qualities. Not a simple thing. Tyler?
Yeah, so the Rambam in Hilchos Asura Bia said, gave the term Gerit Tzedek, or Gerit, whatever the term is, meaning that only those people were Gerit Tzedek, but the other converts are good converts, Lichor. That's what he was saying, no?
Yeah. So a part of what we'll see, and we'll come back to this point, is that there seems to be a difference, that there is an ideal Ger, and there is an acceptable Ger. And I think we mentioned a little bit the other day, and we'll go through this more, is that even if this test wasn't done, or even if this test was failed, so it seems like potentially the Geiris is good. It's not an absolute statement, so we'll have to say more about this, but that the Geiris is valid even without this test or even without a successful test. And we have to see exactly what the parameters of that statement are because it's a very high stakes issue and the subjectivity can be a little bit challenging trying to figure out exactly where it fits in. But it's also noteworthy, and I'm not sure what the answer to this is, but it's interesting if you see the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch. So the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch both emphasize that this is the whole process, that you should do this in order to ascertain whether you are dealing with an appropriate candidate, and then what happens, happens. In the tour, I'm not sure what's behind this exactly, but the tour skips all that. And the tour just says that, b'dieved, or you didn't even say phrase b'dieved, it says that even with an ulterior motive, the geiris is still a geiris once it happens. And the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, they emphasize more that, yes, after the fact, that the geiris is still a geiris, but this is what should be a part of the process. So here we find that Hillel understood that ultimately this was going to be an asset for Klal Yisrael and it's going to be good for this guy. So he ultimately took him. So the Beis Yosef, you have much of a question about that?
I was thinking that doesn't Rav Moshe say that like it's a schus to be a Jew by Ger Katan? So like technically we could always say that it's good for the person to want to become Jewish anyways. So because of that, they should always accept a convert, even if we're not sure about his motivation.
We'll get to that. That's not so simple. That's the Ger Katan especially is a very complex issue. Whether just being Jewish by itself is a schus, even if you're not going to necessarily comply with the whole program, is a complex issue. We have to see if that's true. And that's what the Gemara seems to be saying is not the case, that if it was the only path to redemption, if it was the only path to Olam Haba, so then maybe that would be true. But it's not the only path. So if one could be a tzaddik, the less demanding program as a non-Jew, so then maybe it's not necessarily a zchus for him. So the question of seeing it as a zchus, it's a whole, the sugya of ger katan we want to get to after we do the process of geris, but it's an incredibly relevant and tricky area of contemporary halacha. So we'll see, it's a very significant question whether or not it's an obvious zchus. But what the Gemara really seems to be saying here in Yevamos, to what extent we have a Masechta, but if that's our home base, to what extent we have a home base, that there is a question of who it's good for. Is it good for Klal Yisrael? Is it good for this individual if his motivation and his commitment are less than absolute? Not so clear. That's something we have to try to figure out. But Beis Yosef, noting this Tosfos about Hillel, so the Beis Yosef says what emerges is that we don't have absolute rules as far as this Bechina is concerned, and Hakol Lufi Ruas HaDayin, that ultimately the Dayan has to decide, bottom line, is this a good idea or not? And that any specific question is not going to make or break it, and that these are all clues, and they're all a part of the process. But if at the end of the day, the Dayan says that this is a good plan, that this is going to end up well, so then it's in his prerogative to accept. Because here we have, on the one hand, the Gemara is saying, especially the Rambam, having this detail that if he says he's looking for a prominent position, it's no good. And Hillel accepts somebody who says Beferish is looking for Kuhuna Gedola. So what emerges from that is that you can get a question wrong. It's not absolute. That if the Dayan is able to see that there is a pintel yidden there, I guess literally in this case, if they see that there is a potential, so he can focus on that and ignore the fact that they got the question wrong. Yes, Moshe.
I was just curious, for the Dayan to accept the person, I don't know if you mentioned this, let's say Chas V'Shalom, it doesn't work out, does the Dayan, does he hold any responsibility for the virus or...
Yeah, you know, that's part of the challenge here, you know, and that's why overall Dayanim always have a high stakes kind of profession. And it's what the Chazal say, should always, it's talking about in Mamanus, you know, should always feel like he's got Gehenim open beneath his feet, that it's a challenge, any leadership position. It's part of why the scare was making a mistake looking for one, because any kind of leadership position, there is a tremendous burden of the cost of mistakes, just not necessarily in terms of liability in this world, but in terms of spiritual responsibility. You know, all of us have been spending these past few months trying to decide when to open shul, when not to open shul, what to, you know, what to tell people. There's a lot that is your smicha students should know. There's it's not easy being in positions of authority and responsibility. So it's true here also. We can only do what we can do, but you can only make your best call under good faith circumstances, but also a part of it is trying to be as prepared as possible. So that's why this Gemara is very significant, seeing that the personality of Beis Hillel, the personality of Hillel and his character all contributed to how he goes through this process, how he conducts this process. Now, it's important also to note, it would make a difference that the Marsha commenting on the Tosis, the Marsha suggests that when Hillel accepted him, it didn't mean that he was Megayer him on the spot. That it meant that he said, you know, stick with the program. Okay, you come into my office telling me you're interested in Kahuna Gedola, so listen, stick with me for a while and let's see what happens. So that he wasn't necessarily progressing immediately based on that entrance exam, but that he saw a potential, so he then continued the educational process. So that's going to make a difference also, practically speaking. You know, so it's one thing to say that you can accept someone who's giving you the wrong answers. The question, what does that mean? Accept them and be Megayer them on the spot, or accept them into the program and guide them with the proper kind of education to the point where they'll be the kind of ger that they should be. And the difference, as Tyler was pointing out, that it seems like there is a difference, and Rav Soloveitchik emphasized this in his shiurim, and we'll talk about this more if we have the opportunity, that it sounds like from the sources, the difference, sounds like the Rambam particularly, there's a difference between a ger and a ger tzedek. That a ger tzedek is a idealized standard that we're looking for. But it's possible to have somebody who's a ger, who's not a ger tzedek, who doesn't necessarily satisfy that standard, and what exactly that means practically can be a little bit complex, but maybe ger tzedek is not automatically the status of everyone who's involved in this process. Rav Asher Weiss has a fascinating tshuva in his Tshuvas Minchas Asher, where he considers maybe the other direction. So what if you have a hesitancy that's not based on these concerns? And so if we're reading the Gemara, so we see what are legitimate issues. Improper motivation. Improper commitment to the system. Inadequate knowledge of what they're getting into. And therefore, questionable commitment to the system. So all of these are real issues that we're supposed to look out for. But what if there are other issues? What if, for example, as he discusses, let's say you have a small Jewish community somewhere and somebody wants to convert and live in that community. And you know he's not going to get along with anybody. You know you're going to have constant fights with this guy. It's a troublemaker. Doesn't necessarily check off any of the boxes that the Gemara has talked about, but you know, it's just not going to be a good fit. This is the only place this is the only shul he could be going to. It's a small, far out Jewish community, and this is where he's going to be connecting, and it's not going to be a good shidduch, or literally not going to be a good shidduch. There aren't going to be any women he could marry, and that's going to cause him problems. Or, as he mentions, let's say it's really a side thing. Let's say he's a member of a prominent Christian family, a prominent non-Jewish family. And by welcoming him into the community, so you're going to find yourself in conflict and maybe bring about anti-Semitism. So is that something that you're allowed to factor in? Is that something that should be a part of the process? So Rav Asher considers this question. Part of it, one of the topics we have to get to when we go through the process, so part of the question here is, what exactly is the Beis Din's role? Right? Is the Beis Din basically, and this is a whole sugya that we'll get to, but just to give a preview, that is the Beis Din there just to be a formality? That Geiris essentially is a process that if everything is proper, then it works. And the halacha requires a Beis Din, so the Beis Din has to be there, but basically they're just there to be a stamp, to be a formality. Or is it really Beis Din that is performing the conversion and the Beis Din has to decide if they're comfortable with it, whatever that means. So that's a sugya which has other ramifications, and we'll see it in its context, but that's part of the question here. Is that up to them at all to evaluate beyond what the geirus details are? But ultimately his conclusion is, it says one way or another, it still seems like it's not going to really affect this issue so much. It says what we seem to see is that it's a mitzvah to be mekabel geirim who are appropriate, and side concerns shouldn't enter into it. And that if you're afraid of he's not going to fit in well, or things that are secondary, it's probably not. He doesn't have an absolute proof to this, but it doesn't seem like it's fair to bring that into the equation. And if we see this as a mitzvah when the circumstances are right, so then it doesn't seem like it's appropriate to put too much weight on other factors. And his understanding, he said, again, this is a little bit subjective, which he acknowledges, that they don't have a real proof to this point. But the story of Timna that we saw, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, that says that we got in trouble because our ancestors, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, rejected Timna. So what was going on there? And like we said, presumably it wasn't random. We know that Avram was in the being Makabal Gerim business. So it's not like he had some resistance to anyone. So there must have been some issue. But apparently it wasn't enough of an issue because they're still criticized for it. So it's hard to know how much to get from this because, again, we see a lot of subtleties here, right? So, for example, if we want to put this together with the Hillel story and the Marsha and the Beis Yosef, so there's a big process of subtle evaluation and maybe taking it further and waiting. So when the Gemara says that they shouldn't have pushed her away, maybe it could be read to mean that she wasn't ready to be a Gioris then. But they should have kept her in the circle. They should have tried to figure out how to address that more. And maybe there's, so it's hard to know how much to get from the story. But he brings it as a point here that apparently it was this in-between kind of thing, that she wasn't absolutely disqualified based on the reality, but there was some other issue that they didn't want to take her, and that ended up being something that, as you mentioned before, there's some liability for in that direction, that they paid a price. We all paid a price out of Yom HaZeh, that, or as the Torah says, fight the Malik forever. So we have a eternal problem with this because of this unjustified distancing. So you want to talk about liability, it's a pretty heavy weight. So you had another question, Moshe?
Yeah, I'm sorry to...
No problem.
But I assume that Rav Asher Weiss would say if you had issues of motivation or like the core issues coupled with other side issues, like maybe you would have allowed those issues if it was just motivation, but you could see potential, maybe you would allow it. But if you have that along with other side issues together, would that be enough to say maybe we shouldn't, and then you would disregard potential?
So I think that goes back to the whole Kol Afirus Sadayin idea. So what we see from that point that the author of the Shulchan Aruch, the Beis Yosef, tells us is that ultimately you have to make the call based on what you're comfortable with, based on whatever contributes to the picture. So if it's all coming together to indicate that this is not an appropriate candidate, so then presumably that is legitimate. But I guess what Rav Asher is saying is that if it's not about the central issue, it's just about this isn't a good fit for your shul and you're the only shul, or you're going to have tsaros from the non-Jewish neighbors, why did you grab one of our people? You know, we are very blessed to live in an environment, you know, it has its challenges, but where you have President of the United States can have a child who becomes a part of the Orthodox Jewish community, and that's accepted. So that's we have a unique times. There are all kinds of different dynamics in different communities. So I've witnessed a little bit some of the other direction also. So it's a subtle question, but he's saying that's essentially coming from a different direction. He does note, though, that if it's really a threat, like if you're really worried that the community is going to be physically harmed by taking in this person, so it's not Yehargvay Yavor, and it's not spiritually Yehargvay Yavor either. So that if you feel there's going to be a real risk of some kind to the community by taking this individual in, so then they have the right to preserve their interests and to preserve their own safety. And that's a different story, even though it is a side factor. Everything freeze? Still hear me? My screen froze. What's going on? Everyone seems to have frozen.
Huh. Yeah, Rebbe, we can hear you perfectly. We just, Rebbe's frozen, but.
Yeah, okay, that's weird. I never saw that happen before. Okay, so as long as you can hear me. Okay, so your shocked expressions will have to stay like that. So this question of, you know, if it's really, if it's a side factor, but it's really a danger, so then that would be something that's, okay, you're not obligated to endanger your community, to endanger the people. That's a different story. There is a very controversial issue which he alludes to, and this draws upon a lot of other things, but just, I guess we'll mention it here, that, you know, in the Syrian community, there is a takana within the past century that they're not mekabel gerim at all. And it's a very controversial topic, and there are many who understandably are very uncomfortable with that attitude in light of everything that we have seen. And they feel that this is what has kept them away from intermarriage and has kept the spiritual integrity of the community. So without evaluating that, and it's pluses and minuses, but he does mention that in his Truva as an example of where you might find, okay, if you feel that there's a threat to the community, a spiritual threat to the community, so then maybe that could be understood as a justification to put up a more resistant position. But in general, to have a rejection based on completely external factors, so that's something to be very hesitant and careful about, because it's ultimately not fair to the ger and not in recognition of our obligation to be welcoming. Okay, it's a little unsettling not being able to see anybody's facial reactions. Hopefully this should correct itself. I don't know what's going on. All right, but you can all still hear me, right?
Right.
Okay, so let me ask you this question. So is there any reason to go in the other direction? Should we ever say that there are certain people who we shouldn't resist at all and we should accept them more expediently? Are there any exceptions to this idea? So what would you think? Can you imagine anybody who might be in a category where we should say differently, should say, okay, you go to the express line? I won't be able to see if you raise your hand. Okay, so maybe
someone. Maybe if there is a danger in not like taking them. Yeah, it's
okay.
Me.
Okay, I mean, a danger like of anti-Semitism of that direction. But they want to. Yeah.
Yeah, say that they're like an important person in the community they reside in, and
that's interesting. That's tricky for other reasons. So that clearly would be a problematic gerus, but maybe if there's really a sarkana issue, it's a good question what to do with that. But there are other religious considerations that are debated. So
maybe a suggestion could be, if you have someone who grew up, Jewish, he went to school Jewish, and then finds out later in life that his mom converted, not according to Orthodox Judaism, but he didn't really know about it.
Okay, so that's definitely something that's considered. So Rabbi Reis in his Sefer, so he has a few categories there which he discusses about people who are potentially deserving of a quicker approach. And among them is this issue that there are people, it happens relatively frequently, that you have somebody who was raised Jewish and had every reason to believe they're Jewish and has always practiced Jewish and may be fully observant and may be a full integrated member of the observing community, and then discovers that they actually aren't Jewish, that their mother is not technically Jewish. So it's not an unheard of kind of thing. So maybe such a person should be accepted much more quickly. And it makes sense because, first of all, so you won't have to worry about the observance issues, about knowing what they're going into, about the educational issues. So there is a lot to favor it from that perspective. And from the other side of the equation, there's also a greater risk to delaying. If you have somebody who, both for their own purposes and for their own emotional and dignity needs, and also for certain technical halachic considerations, that if somebody has been Jewish till now and all of a sudden finds they're not, so to leave them in the twilight zone, and both emotionally and practically, and considering also all of the issues of Bishalakum, for example, just to pick one, and many other significant issues that could come up, a lot of other possibilities. So that's a serious consideration, and that's a good motive. It's a good justification to move much more quickly. This is so disorienting. My whole screen is completely frozen. Okay, sorry to. Okay, live check. Everybody still there? Okay. There's a. Sorry.
I have a question.
Yes.
What about let's say a couple that gets engaged, and then throughout the engagement they realize that the woman, you know, they want, that one of them wants to convert now, so they come to you, you know, close to the wedding, and they're not going to delay the wedding. Would we expedite to get her in, or him converted in order to make sure that they're married, you know, whatever? Or do we just say, no, they'll get married in a Jewish ceremony at a regular time?
Okay, so that's a huge question. And I think where the timing is looking like, we'll probably take on that topic tomorrow. And I'll just mention one or two other points today. But the question in general of conversion for the sake of marriage, even separate from the scenario that you described, that part of my screen freezing is that even the clock is not advancing, and I realized later than I thought. So it's a strange thing. But the question of marriage as a motive for conversion is a very complex topic. Obviously, it's a very relevant topic. So I think we'll probably deal with that fresh tomorrow. We'll try to address all those issues. And it comes up even without the time pressure. But let's say you have people who want to get married. So how exactly does that play out? But one other factor related to marriage is, what about you have a couple that's already married? So let's say you have an intermarried couple. So does that justify taking a different attitude and saying that, okay, we will expedite the conversion of a non-Jewish spouse, and maybe we'll go further, maybe we'll even proselytize, and maybe we'll even try to encourage the conversion of a non-Jewish spouse? So that was a major machlokas at Poskim. There are very different attitudes among Poskim to this. Rav Uziel was among those who thought that that's a scenario where we have to take a different kind of attitude. And there were others, such as Tzitz Eliezer, who took a much stronger anti-position and said, no, that's exactly what we don't want, and that's something that should not at all lead in that direction. Maybe it should lead in the opposite direction as far as what kind of attitude of acceptance we would convey. So that's an example where there is a dispute as to whether or not it is the approach that you want to take. Another case where maybe there should be justification for expediting the process is, what if somebody went through a geirus already, but it's a geirus that isn't accepted in the community that they're in, it isn't recognized, and they're otherwise leading a Jewish life, and everything else seems to be consistent and seems to match, so then that may also justify, as some of the Mechabrim have suggested, that that may also justify taking a different approach. And that's less controversial than the whole intermarried situation. You have a person who's leading an observant life. If those are the facts, let's assume for now that those are the facts. They have somebody who is leading an observant life, and just that the conversion that they underwent, to whatever point along the spectrum this is, but is not going to give them credibility and acceptance in the community that they now find themselves. So that may also justify taking a more fast track approach. And once again, you can understand from both sides of the equation why that should be, that it's certainly emotionally very difficult to delay somebody in that position. And a lot of the negative concerns are addressed if they are indeed already living a Jewish life and everything else is in place.
Rabbi, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So I'm not 100% sure about this concept, but I heard about it, you know, through learning. There's a concept, I think, called Zerei Yisrael, if that people are born from, you know, let's say a Jewish dad and a non-Jewish mom, so they're considered this category or this concept of Zerei Yisrael. I don't know if this course is going to address that, but I would assume that that plays very heavily into this also.
Yes, that's a great question, and that's something I also want to try to address a little bit. So maybe we'll trust that tomorrow also. That concept, Zari Yisrael, is the title of a sefer by Rav Amsalem, who's a member of Knesset, if I'm not mistaken, or was a member of Knesset, and has advocated for an approach along those lines. It also touches upon the whole Eretz Yisrael, Chutz La'aretz question, where there are different dynamics, and there's a lot of controversy associated with that. So maybe we'll mention that tomorrow a little bit also with the marriage discussion. And there'll also be another opportunity to come back to these topics, because some of them also impact the question of Kabbalah Samitzvos, which we'll talk about as part of the process of Geirus. Because along the lines, alongside this question, is how accepting can you be of a Geirus where there is a compromised approach, to put it mildly, or matter of degree, is a compromised approach to Kabbalah Samitzvos. So is there ever a justification to assess other factors as being important to oppose that? So that gives us two opportunities to talk about this a little bit more tomorrow to round out this topic, and also in the context of the Kabbalah Samitzvos discussion. Sound good? Still there?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry about this.
Sounds good. Okay. I guess one question I had about the Zari Yisrael in general is, before Rav Amsalem, was there anyone else who talked about it?
He does have sources where he brings in some of the history. I'll fill you in on that a little bit tomorrow.
Okay, perfect.
Okay, so just to quickly recap what we spoke about today. So we spoke about this question of pushing away Geirim initially, of creating a resistance, playing hard to get, that we have this common knowledge of it being three times, but it doesn't seem to appear in Shas. Seems to be based on this Medrash Rus and the Torah Tmima commenting, how could it be that the Gemara and the Poskim don't tell us this important din? And Rabbi Reis noting that you could extract at least two, if not three times, from the Gemara and Yavamas. And putting the two together, what we have is a number from the Medrash and different types from the Gemara, and we could put those together, that we're basically looking for motivation, and we're also looking for an understanding of what they're getting into and a picture of how strong the commitment will be. And as also as the Nachlat Tzvi also had observed, these two different purposes in trying to investigate. And we saw that Srara is brought up, at least by the Rambam, as an example of a bad motive. And yet the Gemara tells us that Hillel was Makabel, somebody who was looking for Kahuna Gedola. And Tosfos says in Yavamas, that's because he understood that ultimately it was going to be good. And the Beis Yosef has this important Yisod. You see, it's all based on the Dayan's assessment. And taken with the Maharsha's comment that he didn't accept him right away, he just kept him close to further evaluate, all of that paints a picture of great nuance and subtlety and important interpersonal skills as far as how to relate to the candidate. It all plays a part in creating a picture of what exactly should happen. And we saw that Rav Asher Weiss has a tshuva about, can you reject somebody for side reasons, such as he won't get along with the community, he won't find a shidduch, he is going to bring about anti-Semitism because of his family or the like. And essentially he concludes that it's really not right to push off for those reasons. His understanding is that that's what happened with Timna and with Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov. Unless it's really a threat, if the person's really going to bring physical harm to the community or spiritual harm, as maybe the understanding of the Syrian community. So maybe that should factor in. And then we discussed in the other direction, is there anybody who does not get pushed off? And we saw a couple of possible suggestions. Rabbi Reis discusses in his sefer some of these categories. The controversial one is an intermarried individual. Do we say that if somebody is already in a marriage with a Jew, so then we should try to minimize the harm there and welcome that person more eagerly than we otherwise would, maybe even reach out to them to convert? That was a major machlokas haposkim, where you have some very different attitudes. And the other two categories are less controversial. One, if somebody went through a conversion that they find now is not accepted in this community, or if they have been living a Jewish life and they discover that they're not Jewish, as tends to happen sometimes. So then that would seem from every side to be a reason to expedite, both from the emotional and dignity consequences of delaying, and also the other factors already established. If they've been living an observant life their whole existence and they think that that's what they were the whole time, so then they've already proven a lot of what needs to be assessed. And that's another reason to perhaps take a different approach. Okay, so God willing, tomorrow we'll pick up with the issue of marriage, maybe Zer Yisrael, and some other related things. And hopefully we'll have a decent picture of this whole entrance exam process by the end of the week. So tomorrow again is a tinus, but hopefully shouldn't get in our way. We'll try to persevere despite the hunger. And if Mashiach comes in the next few hours, so then we won't have to worry about that either. But otherwise, I wish you a safe and healthy day and a safe and healthy beginning of the tinus. And I will see you, God willing, tomorrow.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Quick question.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Yes, question, sorry. Yeah.
Do you know where we could find the tshuva of Rav Asher?
Yes, it is in Chelek Aleph. Where is it? Actually, I will send it out to you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay. Shkach Kol Tov.
Yes. Question. I was more like a ha'ara. I thought it was interesting that we have such an emphasis on telling the potential ger to that, you know, it's hard to be Jewish, you know, like all the scary things about Judaism. And I just thought, as I recently saw it, and Simon pointed it out, Rav Moshe famously said that it's hard to be a Jew mentality to destroy a whole generation.
Yeah.
It's so interesting that, like, it seems like we do have that in our mind, though, that, like, Judaism is not easy. And when you express that at a time where a person wants to become Jewish, we're even telling them, like, when you get into it, it's not going to be easy. So, like, it's just an interesting, you know, idea.
Yeah, it is a fascinating point. Yeah, and Rav Moshe makes that point a lot. You know, he was quoted, I remember, in the Art Scroll biography, they quote him as saying that. And if you read, for example, in the Darish Moshe, so he interprets a lot of stories in Chumash along those lines, that it's important that we destroy chinuch by telling, we destroy our children by telling them that it's Shveretz Zayin Yid. Right. And it seems like these two points are somewhat in tension, but not necessarily, because ultimately what we really believe is that the value of being a Jew outweighs all of the suffering. And that's why we're here, that we really believe ultimately that it's all worth it. But we also need that everyone else understand it. So we want our children to understand that. Certainly we want them to appreciate that the price is worth it and that whatever issues they have to go through are outweighed by the value. And we also want the ger to appreciate that. So we need to make sure that he knows the cost to see that ultimately he's going to say, yes, I realize that it doesn't seem easy, and yet the value is worth it.
Right.
So when he has that attitude, so then we say, great, come on in. But essentially it's the same point as Rav Moshe.
Right.
That there's an external perception that is difficult, and we would like ourselves and our children and all the Jews to recognize that the good outweighs the bad. But we want the ger to also appreciate that too. So we want to say, okay, you realize about the bad, right? You realize about what difficulties you can go through. And if you say, yeah, but still, it would be an honor for me to be a part of the Jewish people because the good is greater to me, than we say Gevaltik. That's exactly Rav Moshe's point.
Right.
The bottom line is not as sure as I need it.
Right. Okay. Okay, thank you very much, Rabbi.
Okay, Ashikach. I'll see you tomorrow, and hopefully we'll be able to actually see you. My computer should come back to life. Okay. Thanks again. I can. Anyone hear me? Man, it's a crazy situation. I froze in the middle of the Zoom. No button works.
Right.
They were able to hear me. I may still be there for them. I officially ended a class a few minutes ago, but they were able to still hear. But mm-hmm. I couldn't see anybody's facial expressions or anybody raising their hand or anything.
Right. Tell them who graduated.
He's Micha, yeah.
Oh, nice.
It's a class, but I.
Is the mouse over?
Oh, wow. It's completely. And I don't even. I unplugged it, but it has like. Ironically, the plug has also been an issue because it falls out half the time. All of a sudden.
Well, it's not dead, or else this would be like off.
I can't do anything. So this is the only button I can figure out that's supposed to turn it off. Right? Is there another physical button?
No. See, you could, there might be a keyboard shortcut.
That would be this. Control Alt Delete isn't working.
Is he from Chennai?
Anna Paul?
Yeah.
Not sure.
His brother might be in my grade.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you could just close your computer.
I didn't do anything. I tried it a few times.
that hold.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing that will happen is if you unplug it and just leave it out here.
I know, but then I
gotta die.
Right, that's crazy. And how long it's gonna take to die?
It says it could take up to 10 seconds to hold on.